Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, we got a real treat for you, an exclusive sit-down conversation with Congressman Dan Crenshaw. It is a conversation you do not want to miss. We go into all things impeachment, size and scope of government, and we have a pretty spirited disagreement on the U.S. role in Afghanistan. But before we go any further, make sure you are subscribed to the Charlie Kirk Show. Type in Charlie Kirk Show to your podcast provider. Press subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review. Take out your phone and do it right now. Buckle up, everybody. We got a big show in store for you. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
So this conversation with Congressman Crenshaw, as you're listening to this, I guarantee this is going to make news, because all of this conversation was done before the attack on our embassy in Iraq, before the Iranian conflict where we killed Soleimani. And I was just making general points and observations about reckless U.S. foreign policy of toppling sovereign nations like we did in Iraq and the endless war in Afghanistan. And Congressman Crenshaw and I respectfully disagreed. Now, he is a hero of the United States. He's a very smart man. But we did not necessarily agree on every single issue throughout this podcast. But that's what it's all about. And I'm going to give you one more piece of foreshadowing about this episode. But before I do, amazing football coming up this weekend. We got the Niners and Vikings. I will be there. Go Jimmy Garoppolo. Go Niners. I got to support Chicago's own Rolling Meadows High School. Jimmy Garoppolo, Eastern Illinois University, the best quarterback in the NFL. And don't give me that Lamar Jackson nonsense. Okay, we'll see if Lamar Jackson is able to withstand a playoff campaign. He's pretty good, though. The Ravens look pretty well suited. I got Packers-Seahawks. Is that right? Packers-Seahawks. Aaron Rodgers looks to be playing some of his best football. I have a lot of respect for the Packers organization. Now, as I'm talking about these sports, this is brought to you by betonline.ag. Don't forget that promo code podcast1. If you disagree with my picks, then go to betonline.ag. Use that promo code podcast1 to get in on the action. Before I talk more about NFL, though, we got LSU-Clemson national championship coming up. Joe Burrow, probably the best college athlete that I have seen in quite some time. Absolutely incredible. Well-deserved Heisman. I love the story of these college transfers. I think the transfer rule is one of the most positive developments in college sports in recent years. It allows amazing athletes like Joe Burrow the opportunity to be able to compete at the highest level. I mean, he, of course, was an Ohio native, went to Ohio State University, then transferred to LSU. And again, this is, and if you think, oh my goodness, Clemson's going to win the national championship, then go to betonline.ag, use that promo code podcast1. Huge NFL action. We love our friends at betonline.ag. Some huge games coming up. There's NBA games, I guess, if that's your style. Lakers, Dallas, Houston, Oklahoma City, but you should be focused on football this week. Football, everybody. BetOnline.ag. Use that promo code podcast1. All right. So now, as you know, there is a lot of conflict happening in the Middle East. It's my opinion that America should stand up for our own sovereign soil, that being our embassies and the homeland, against attacks of people that hate us. I think the Iranian regime is an evil regime. However, I think the stance to have endless war in the Middle East is an incorrect stance, and I think that the proper approach should be a more restrained U.S. foreign policy, especially as our country is $22 trillion in debt, as our borders are wide open, our infrastructure is crumbling, and we have kids in our inner cities that cannot read. When you have so many problems in our country that we have it, I do not think we should be spending and sending billions and billions and billions of dollars to Afghanistan endlessly. So with that, I give you the exclusive conversation with an American hero and a great U.S. congressman that we do not agree on everything, but he is still someone worthy of great respect and admiration. We talk impeachment, Afghanistan, size and scope of government. Enjoy my conversation with Congressman Dan Crenshaw. We are here at the Charlie Kirk Show with Congressman Dan Crenshaw. Congressman, welcome.
Great to be with you.
So there's been a little bit in the news lately with impeachment.
Yeah.
So how did you vote?
I was a no vote.
That's a surprise.
It was a tough one.
I'll say this, and I wouldn't want your job right now. It's a circus.
It is. I mean, you know, people always ask me, are you enjoying it? Are you enjoying it? And I said, well, it's not enjoyable in the traditional sense. I actually did think my old job was enjoyable. Yes, you lose a body part every once in a while. But
a vital organ.
Yeah.
Minor details.
Not a vital organ.
You is that right?
You have two eyes. So you don't.
But it is an organ.
You don't need the other one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I guess technically it's an organ, sure. But you just have to turn your head more. It's like that scene from the Avengers when I think Tony Stark was walking through the big mega ship they had, and he's looking around. He's like, he's covering one eye. And he's like, how does Nick Fury see these? And what's her name? She was like Nick Fury's prime assistant. Like, what was
the actress or the actual character?
The character or the actress. Either way, she's like, he turns. So it's not all that bad. Anyway.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. It's the young lady with, she's a redhead.
Yeah.
I'll think about it.
She was in How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah, that narrows it down.
Yeah. You don't watch How I Met Your Mother?
No, it's not Gwyneth Paltrow, is it?
No. No, no. That's Tony Stark's. That's, wow.
No, the actress.
You really don't watch any of these, like, these
I'm
superhero
sure
movies,
I do.
Right? Because I just watched your conversation with Dave Rubin about Star Wars.
I was educated enough until the Disney Plus extended version of some thing that no
it
one...
It is too much. I agree.
It's over.
I don't even know why we were talking about the Avengers.
Because you have to
Congress.
Yeah, that's right.
Congress is tough. Okay. So the question was, is it enjoyable? And I'm like, you know, it's not enjoyable in the traditional sense. Like, I liked shooting and jumping out of airplanes. Like, that to me is enjoyable. There's things about it that perhaps are not enjoyable. Congress has none of those fun things, but it's fulfilling. There's a sense of purpose involved. I get to have a say in the direction of policy and the general conversation in our country. And so that in and of itself is fulfilling. But yeah, I mean, it's a blood sport. And you're finding that out more and more. I mean, the depths to which the left will go to undermine your character, to spread lies about you. And no, it's not a both sides do this kind of thing. Like, it's just not.
Mm-hmm.
Not because conservatives are a bunch of saints, but because we can't get away with it. The media is it will scrutinize whatever a conservative says. They don't do that to the left, right? And, and like a lot of us often say, I just want the media to treat the left the same way they treat the right. You know, that's it. I'm not even asking. We're not even asking for less scrutiny. We just want to be treated the same.
No, they're an activist wing of the Democrat Party.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. What's been your biggest frustration with this whole impeachment process? Not to mention the inability to cross-examine witnesses, all of it, but just in general for you personally.
Well, it's just the premise. It's built on a falsehood, right? The falsehood being this, that it's absolutely wrong to ask about the Biden-Burisma relationship. Like, that's the ultimate question. Now, I think our messaging finally got to that as a party.
That's very well said.
But it wasn't always there. Like, we were screaming about the skiff, and we were screaming about the process. And yeah, that's true. That was all bad.
It was all nonsense.
But we should have been focusing on the first question, which was, why can't Trump ask about that? Like, really, why not? Oh, because he's running for president? I mean, meaning Biden is running for president. Well, that's not a very good reason. Like, what, that gives you immunity all of a sudden?
Well, can Trump not get investigated by House Democrats because he's running for president?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Can they not impeach him because he's running for president?
Right. He is running for president.
He's an active candidate.
He announced.
So they just did election interference.
Technically, he announced. By their logic, yeah.
He announced back in June he's an official candidate for the presidency.
Right.
So this whole thing is...
Can't touch him.
They can't investigate him. They can't touch him. They can't do any of it.
And that's the absurd logic. And they make a huge analytical leap from there. They say he was asking for help with the 2020 election. Well, that's a huge analytical leap. You have to... There's no evidence to suggest that, okay? There's plenty of evidence to suggest that Trump was interested in this Biden-Burisma issue. Okay, plenty of evidence to suggest that.
For very good reasons.
Because he said so, right? But again, why is it not in the public interest to know about a inherently corrupt, I mean, corrupt on its face, okay, just with the facts we all know and agree upon, relationship between Hunter Biden and Burisma, and then the fact that Vice President Biden tried to get the prosecutor fired, who was investigating the company that Hunter Biden was a board member on. Of course, it's in the public interest to know about that. You can make all sorts of arguments about how Trump asked about it and who should have done that kind of questioning. Fine, but that's pretty nitpicky at that point. It doesn't even come close to the level of, I think, election interference by any means.
So Congressman, they impeached him for obstruction of Congress. Mm. And if I were to make an argument of, hey, if you want to get reelected, have them impeach you for obstructing Congress. Everyone hates Congress. Like, of course you're obstructing Congress. Like,
you have a very
like,
low.
I mean, no offense
rating.
To you, but like, we hate Congress. I hate Congress. I mean, you're one of the good guys there, but yeah. They have like a 9% approval rating.
Yeah.
Like, of course you're going to obstruct them. Like, how's that? First of all, it's not even impeachable.
No.
But people should love that.
It's, you would think everybody, you know, everybody hates Congress, but they love their Congress.
Well, that's the irony of it. Yeah, it's like everyone hates Congress, but they elect their congressman with 60%.
Yeah, it's a popular thing to say, right? Like, well, government, Congress, I get it. But let's focus in on this really quick, the obstruction of Congress and what that means, because it's not obstruction of justice. All right, and that's an important distinction, and mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are conflating the two casually and lazily. They're not the same thing. Obstruction of justice is a very specific crime. It can be proven with, you know, there has to be malintent there. In this case, they're mostly talking about subpoenas. I think they also added in some things about the president's tweets, but that, I mean, that's absurd, and we all know that as far as intimidating witnesses. But they're focusing more on subpoenas. Okay, so the administration refused to comply with certain subpoenas. Now, if you do that with a court order, that is very clearly obstruction of justice. But there's no court orders here. Mm-hmm. Okay, so once the Congress decides that it wants the someone from the executive branch to come testify, and that person from the executive, or the president says, no, I'm going to invoke executive privilege. I'm going to prevent you from coming. Then it goes to the courts. It's for the courts to decide this. Alan Dershowitz actually had a very good analysis on this. He's like, the fact that the Supreme Court said it would hear the case unrelated to impeachment, because there's other cases I think in New York, they're trying to
get the tax returns.
They're subpoenaing Trump officials. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, which in and of itself indicates that this should be in the court's hands.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's an important,
that's exactly right.
It's a wonky point, but it's an important
point. Well, and John Bolton's the best example of this. So John Bolton was getting subpoenaed by House investigators, but also was getting orders on executive privilege from the White House. So his attorney went to the D.C. court and said, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me. And basically the judge was like, well, we have to decide this, you know. And you know what happened? The House investigators dropped their subpoena. They just said, okay, they walked away from it.
Right. Because they know.
Yeah, but that's the total, that is in a perfect sense, the three branches of government tension between it.
Right.
And the founder said, how do you break the tie? Because there will be tension between the White House and tension between the Senate.
Not just would be, but should be.
Yeah, healthy, actually.
It's how things are supposed to be. So that natural friction that occurs in a separation of powers style government, well, it will occur. And this is exactly what happens. So you can't, again, false premises, right? So the obstruction of Congress charge relies on the false premise that the president should participate in his own impeachment investigation. No, you can't make him do that, right? And when he doesn't want to do that, you can't then say, well, now we're going to impeach you. I mean, that in and of itself is an abuse of power, which of course their other article.
Well, and then also there's powers that Congress has over the executive that the executive does not always have. For example, you can't FOIA Congress.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. You can Freedom of Information Act the White House, and they have.
Right.
And eventually a lot of communications will be made public at a later date. And so the first article is obstruction of Congress. And the second was abuse of power, which is so broad.
Right. And abuse of power, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about that first initial question. Is it wrong to ask about the Biden-Burisma relationship? And is that an abuse of power? Well, only, I mean, you could argue it is, but only if you can prove unequivocally that this was for the election, which they didn't even come close to doing. Right. I mean, it was just never mentioned. Now, if he had been asking the Ukrainians about Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, two people who haven't really had any interaction with the Ukraine at all,
the case would be a little stronger.
The case would be very strong. But that just isn't the case here, because on its face, the Biden issue is corrupt. There's a clear conflict of interest there. I'm not the only one who says that. All of the witnesses who were asked about this during the testimonies agreed.
Even the ones that were testifying against Trump.
Right.
Ambassador
right.
Taylor said the exact same
right.
thing.
Of course we had concerns. Okay, then why can't we ask about
That's
it?
That's right.
Well, because he's on our team.
Yeah, precisely. So President Trump just signed the National Defense Authorization Act. I have my concerns with parts of it. I like parts of it. What's your immediate reaction on it? You voted for it?
Yeah, I mean, I voted for both bills. There was two mini-bus appropriations bills.
$1.3 trillion?
Yeah. And my explanation is this. if I was going to be against them, it would be because of top line spending. It's just overall too much money. But these were appropriations bills. They weren't top line spending bills. We already voted for the budget cap deal earlier this year, and I voted against that because, just for the simple reason, it's just too much money. There wasn't good reasoning behind spending that much money. These are appropriations bills that tell us what we're going to do with that money and effectively prevent a government shutdown. So we voted for them because, mostly in good faith towards our negotiators on the Appropriations Committee. Are they perfect? No, but you're never going to get a perfect budget bill. And if that's your standard, then you'll just never vote for anything. And that's fine. A lot of members of Congress do that.
Thomas Massey.
Yeah, he votes literally against everything.
He's great.
Yeah, I mean, some people are into that, right?
Like I am.
I'm not. And I mean, that's not my thing. I get it both ways.
I understand it.
Yeah. But this was a well-negotiated bill. There was a lot of things that I happen to like in it. You know, it's going to be hard for me coming from Houston, for instance. Remember, all politics turns local eventually. You know, money for maintenance in the Houston Ship Channel. It's a huge deal for Houston and, frankly, the entire economy. Things like, you know, FEMA disaster funding when we have lots of rainstorms in Houston. Things like that, more broadly speaking, removal of taxes on things like biomedical device sales, Cadillac tax, things like that. There's a lot of good things. Yeah. You can name a bunch of bad things.
What I wish,
right?
And this will never happen, but I wish it didn't have to be lumped into all one thing. They could be done into 500 micro bills.
That's how it's supposed to happen.
I know, it's not going to happen, but they do this for a lot of different reasons, time, and I also have a much more cynical view. I think they do it so they can lump bad stuff into it as well. So it's that tension.
That's true. I mean, but it's openly true because it's a negotiation. And that's just the reality that we live in, I think. And so, yes, it is because they can lump bad stuff in, but not because everybody wants the bad stuff. It's just because that's the negotiation. Remember, my view of bad stuff is different than what Democrats' view of bad stuff is. Mm-hmm. And so that is why it happens. It's not great. We're all always looking for a better budget process. I wish there was one. The other thing I say about it is this. If we're concerned about the top line spending, and I think we are, then we have to examine that really quick. And it goes something like this. So people who are in the millennial generation or Gen Z generation should be pretty concerned about the long-term debt. And then we have to ask ourselves what's causing the long-term debt. The thing is it's not discretionary spending. The reality is, as a share of GDP, that continues to decrease. You know, even our military spending, even though it seems astronomical, it continues to decrease as a share of GDP. Our revenues remain about the same. The Democrats would, of course, disagree with that, but they'd also be wrong. In fact, our revenues are even with the tax cuts, are on a trajectory to continue increasing. So then what is causing our deficits? What is causing our massive debt? It's entitlement spending. And none of that is addressed in these appropriations bills. That's the real problem. So I think a lot of, and especially conservatives, they get a lot of political points by yelling and screaming about these appropriations bills every time. But what we really should be doing is immediately focusing on the entitlement spending.
Right. And that to be even extra cynical, the likelihood of that happening is next to nothing.
Yeah, and you know why? The American people need to want it.
Well, and
that's,
you also have the AARP, which is the most powerful lobby in
the
country.
Frustrating.
That is rigged against any sort of reform for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid less so, but there still needs to be Medicaid reform.
Yeah.
But very simple adjustments, such as raising the retirement age.
Yeah.
Even having people over a certain income level having,
right.
I mean, if you earn more than $2 million a year over the age of 60, I mean, yeah. I think it's fair to say, and even those minor changes, because the asset pool is so big, can actually make it more sustainable for months and then years on end. How many of you guys out there have personal loans or student loans? Well, I'm here to tell you about Credible. What is Credible? An online marketplace that gets you pre-qualified student loan refinancing rates from up to 10 different lenders. The benefits of refinancing to a lower rate is primary. You save on interest or lower your monthly payment, more money in your paycheck, or sometimes both. Secondary, you consolidate all your student loan bills in one place. With a lower term, you get debt-free faster. You get serious peace of mind. Credible customers have given awesome reviews about how much better their lives are after refinancing. You see actual pre-qualified rates, whereas some online marketplaces you'll get range of rates or ballpark estimates. It only takes a couple minutes to check rates. You'll just fill in some basic info like name and address. Checking rates doesn't impact your credit. They're so confident that they have the best rates, they'll give you $200 if you close a loan with a better rate elsewhere. They never sell your data, so you won't receive spam or phone calls from dozens of lenders. I know I hate that. Please visit right now, Credible.com/Charlie. That's CREDIBLE.com/Charlie. And when you can close a loan via Credible, they'll give you a $200 gift card. You just fill in a couple pieces of info to check what rates you're available, and they don't charge you for checking your credit. Again, that's Credible.com/Charlie. Credible.com/Charlie. Refinance and start saving today. So one thing, and I mean, you heroically served our country overseas that I don't know if we see the same on, is the war in Afghanistan. I'm a huge outspoken critic of it.
I've noticed.
I think it's long past time to end the war in Afghanistan. The American people tend to agree with that. Polling shows it's kind of underwater. Convince me or convince the audience, as I have an open mind, what does success look like? What does victory look like? We spent $5 billion on Afghan security forces, mm-hmm. where there's questions of that, if that's even effective. We've spent over $1 trillion, lost thousands of people. I'm sure you knew people that served over there. Make the case that we should continue the occupation in Afghanistan.
Well, you asked a lot of questions. So one was, what do we get out of it? What we get out of it is not another 9/11 every single day. And the problem, I think the reason that the American people have this opinion, and you're right, it is underwater as far as public opinion goes, and there's a lot of people who hold the opinion that you have. The president himself is very skeptical of it. And I think the reason behind that is because there's been a lot of leaders who have been constantly saying that we're going to win and we've got to win. And then everybody's like, okay, but what does winning look like? And we've never been honest about what winning looks like. I'm very honest about what winning looks like.
So winning is preventing a massive terrorist attack.
Winning is preventing.
So who
is prevent? And it's preventing the ability of these people who wake up every single day and want to kill us. And yes, we do go there so that they don't come here. And I know you think that's the dumbest thing you've ever heard. And I've heard you say that, but it's not. And it's not. And I know this from my own experience.
Who was behind 9/11? How many people from Afghanistan were behind 9/11?
Well, it doesn't matter. They're all from Saudi Arabia. I get what you're saying but it was very obvious.
I mean, who was behind the Pensacola shooting? I mean, to your argument, why don't we go to Saudi Arabia to make sure they don't come here?
Well, we are in Saudi Arabia.
Right. But no, so, we sell them arms. We train their pilots.
Right. Well,
we don't have a military occupation of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I understand that. But you also know that the government of Saudi Arabia isn't actively trying to destroy our country. And if you do believe that, then
I don't.
There's no proof.
I don't. But, I mean, there's pockets of the royal family that have been.
Well, okay. Well, let's examine why we went to Afghanistan. We went to Afghanistan because Al-Qaeda was harbored there by the Taliban and they refused to give them up. So I guess my first question to you then would be, do you disagree with us going into Afghanistan in the first place?
Yes, absolutely. The way we did with a huge ground invasion. We did more in the first 100 days post 9/11 with people like you, Special Forces, Green Berets, tactical strikes, than hundreds of thousands of ground troops trying to do the exercise of nation building.
You don't disagree with the initial invasion. You just disagree with nation building?
Well, yeah. I mean, spending.
Those are two separate things. You got to pick those apart.
The initial invasion with hundreds of thousands of ground troops, absolutely. The question I ask you is, 15 years later, is Afghanistan in a better place or a worse place?
Yeah, but well.
And are we safe? Do you think we're safer because of the war in Afghanistan?
Has there been another 9/11? No, there hasn't. So yes.
But they were never behind it, though.
They were. I mean, they were overtly sanctioning the people
Iran's,
who committed it.
There was an Emirati. There was an Egyptian.
Right. But we knew.
There were lots of players.
I understand that. But we knew that the main people planning it were hiding out in Afghanistan.
And Pakistan. Osama bin Laden was behind.
They eventually fled to Pakistan. But yes. So you can't really deny that fact. And I'm still trying to get what your opinion is on should we have sent anybody there in the first place to counterattack.
Special forces, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. But you have to understand. Okay. Well, this gets into a misunderstanding of military tactics. It's nice to think, and I think this is an important point, because there's a big misunderstanding here, which is that we're America. We can just reach out and touch people anytime we want. It doesn't work that way. Like the Baghdadi raid never would have happened if we didn't already have a bunch of people there already, eyes and ears on the ground, a very robust source network, a very robust SIGINT network. That does not happen without people there. You have to understand that. There has to be a forward presence. Special operations troops, you can't just forget about us in the mountains of Afghanistan. Like, there has to be some kind of backside support. All right. And I think back then too, and you can argue against this, but there wasn't a thinking about if you break it, you own it. Okay. And that was the thinking in Iraq. And again, it's highly debatable, but also hindsight's 20/20. It actually did work in Iraq. By the time 2010 rolled around, when I was there on my last deployment to Iraq,
what worked in Iraq?
The nation building. Like, it was an effectively a stable place. It needed a very small an increasingly smaller presence from us to actually
after
keep
we
it.
Spent $2 trillion we didn't have it's and expensive. Lost thousands of American lives.
Again,
I mean,
yeah, and again,
and invaded a sovereign country on questionable intelligence.
You can argue that for sure, but I'm talking about the concept of nation building by itself. It works in places like Iraq. I don't think it'll ever work in places like Afghanistan
or Libya,
which is well, we didn't even try in Libya, but
displaced Gaddafi.
I get that, but we didn't even bother with it after that. So it's a whole separate example. But focusing on Afghanistan, if I'm trying to pick apart what you're in favor of and what you're not in favor of, it sounds like you're in favor of the initial counterattack, right? These people did this to us, and we had to respond. Okay, check. But you don't like that we sent a lot of people there afterwards to train their forces, to build bigger bases. What I'm trying to explain here is that that choice isn't as simple as you're making it out to be. Right, you have to have that backside support, and also,
so
and
I also,
and, and then they're, and then they're thinking ahead, and this is the other thing: they're thinking ahead, right? A few years ahead, 5 years ahead. You didn't kill everybody. You didn't end the Al Qaeda presence there. The Taliban themselves are closely aligned with the Al Qaeda ideology. There's no reason to think that they will continue to support them. And so, if you just pick up and leave, which is what I hear a lot,
yes, we should.
Okay, then they're just going to do it again.
Do what again?
Another 9/11,
okay.
Another planet.
But again,
attack.
Let's the apparatus behind 9/11, the physical training ground was assisted by the Taliban, assisted by Al Qaeda, also assisted by Iran and many royal families in Saudi Arabia. So it was a multinational Middle Eastern collusion against the United States.
Sure.
So to be consistent with your argument, we should be present in all of those countries. Right.
We and are actively thwarting all of those countries.
So you agree
we don't invade them all. But we are actively associated.
We're not thwarting Saudi Arabia. We're training their pilots, and they kill our people. We sell them billions of dollars of arms, and we're supporting their war in Yemen.
Yeah, I mean, again, we should be mad at Saudi Arabia for giving us that pilot, but it's not as if he was directed by the government of Saudi Arabia.
No, I'm not saying that, but there's plenty of people in the royal family.
But your argument relies on that premise, right? Because like it does. And
do you think Saudi intelligence knew it was going to happen or no?
No, I don't.
Okay,
I really
some
don't.
People do.
I would like to see proof of that.
Okay.
We have no reason to
when
suspect
that. When they have 15
that.
Of their citizens leaving their country.
Right.
And listen, billions of dollars leaving in wire transfers, and Osama bin Laden was part of the Saudi royal family.
I mean, if
it's
you had
questions.
A bunch, of course there's questions, but if you had a bunch of Americans that went over and murdered a bunch of people in the Middle East just randomly, would you find it absurd that people would accuse our government
no,
of sending them
No, but we're not
there?
A theocratic police state, though. That's the difference. In Saudi Arabia, one wire transfer gets sent. Rumors spread instantaneously. You know, it's a very insular community.
Right. But again, we've just never seen any evidence of it. So there's and until we did. And it's not like it's not as if our intelligence community didn't look into these things. I don't think it's healthy to just go believing that when there's no evidence.
But I also don't think it's healthy to go just invade and occupy the country that they happen to be partially trained in, the intelligence network behind it. For 20 years, spend $2 trillion, lose 5,000 Americans,
again,
and just say the argument is we're not going to let this happen again because of that.
But that's a pretty good argument, right? Because
but we've
lost more
people fighting against it that were lost in 9/11.
Well,
so we've lost more troops in the war in Afghanistan than the people on 9/11.
I understand that.
The next 11 happened in the Middle East.
I don't understand why that's your criteria because we're talking about military troops, guys like me, who go over there on our
total
own,
heroes.
Voluntarily,
to prevent
further atrocities on innocent people in the United States. So no, I cannot conflate those numbers. Like they're not comparable, right? These are different kinds.
But they're both Americans, right? So
they are.
When 5,000 people go overseas and die, it's the same citizenry that's dying in New York City.
I understand that, but again. People like me going overseas to protect people back home, we are willing to sacrifice for that. I think it's overly simplistic to simply compare those things as numbers.
I think it's
right?
fair, but
it's a highly simplistic way of looking at this. And again, this gets back to what is the mission, and the mission is prevention. It always has been. Now, I think the reason we're having this discussion is because for too long leaders were telling you that the mission was winning. Okay, winning what? Because that's an honest question. Like, winning what? Well, and we would have sort of a complex strategy. Well, we need to build capacity within the Afghan government. We need to create some kind of economy there so that they're stable, so that this crap doesn't keep happening. Now, I think that's a pretty good argument by itself. But the other argument is literally prevention. You have to understand how this enemy thinks. and you've never seen this enemy like I have, and like all of us, and I think that's another reason. A lot of people just don't know these things. These people do wake up every single day, and they think of ways to kill us. And this happened well before 9/11. This happened well after 9/11, right? If they're not thinking of ways to attack the base where a bunch of armed guys like me are waiting for them, they're thinking of ways to attack the homeland. And I don't know how much proof over and over again we need of this. And this is the same conversation in Syria with ISIS, right? Like you can take this conversation we're having about Afghanistan and transfer it to the Syrian problem. The reason I had a problem with an immediate pullout from Syria, with by the way, which was just a very small contingent of troops, a very efficient size number of troops, not costing us a whole lot. We're not losing people really, but it literally keeps eyes and ears on the ground. And you need that because when these people are left alone and they have space to operate and they have time to plan, well, that's exactly what they start doing. They're not just there to be left alone. They're not libertarians. Okay, like they're not there. They don't just want to farm their dirt and raise their families. They are always thinking about ways to attack the West. They have an ideological hatred that is irrational to us, but they have that hatred towards the West. And you can't ignore that simple fact, and you can't ignore the fact that we need to be there to see what they're planning.
Do you think we should ever end the current war in Afghanistan in the next decade, as it is now?
I mean, a very small contingent of troops. No, I mean it's dependent on the situation. I mean, let me first say I agree with your skepticism of nation building, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in Afghanistan,
which we tried.
Especially in Afghanistan and in the rural areas. But just because I'm skeptical of nation building there doesn't mean I also can't say, well, it did kind of work in Iraq. I mean, I watched it work. Okay, it took some time.
So you would argue the Federation of Iraq worked and then Obama pulled out and that's what was the impetus.
100%. I mean, I was there. I was there during that transition. And we could all sense what was going to happen. And so, you know, again, you have to engage in these conversations with nuance. So, yes, I would say you're going to continue to need an American presence in Afghanistan that is mostly special operations focused, building capacity within the Afghan army. Building capacity within their political system, making sure that they're not going off in some crazy direction. But does that mean we need to be sending guys like me to patrol the minefields of Kandahar? Less so, right? There's a good argument that that's maybe a bad use of our troops' time at this point in the war. But the cities of Afghanistan, Kandahar, Kabul, these are civilizations, right? They're skyscrapers, right? There's casinos. Okay. There's something to work with there. And, they're relatively safe compared to what's going on in the rural side of the country. So yes, you can hole up there. You can continue to support the government, make sure that they're still on our side in some kind of way and that they're still taking the fight to the enemy there. And not being completely overrun. It's not a high cost for us.
Do you think
this.
The Taliban is stronger now or was it stronger 10 years ago?
Oh, they were pretty strong 10 years ago. That was a bad time in Afghanistan. So, you know, but you can look at the strength of the Taliban ebbing and flowing over time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were at their weakest when we had the most people there. That's always going to be the case. So if we put 200,000 troops there, there's a good chance we'll win. It'll be bloody, and people don't like blood.
But
back home.
Didn't we try that? I mean, we
tried it, and we were winning. But then we pulled it right back, right? And we had a timeline of when we were going to pull back. So it's very easy if you're the Taliban to plan ahead for that. And this is the problem with politically led wars. And by politically, I mean, you know, we have a president who is subject to the opinions of the people, and as he should be, but the opinions of the people tend to be somewhat emotional in this, and they're not going to engage in nuanced discussion of like what's working and what isn't. So the president, this is why President Obama, I think, said, we're going to have a timeline. You know, we're going to have a timeline. We're going to put a bunch of troops there. We're going to win. And then we're going to have a timeline and pull them out. Well, it's terrible military strategy, but it's much better political strategy for him. And that's a problem when we're trying to win militarily. Now, I've told the president, The situation he has right now, or he has had during his presidency, and the way he's managed that has actually been the right mix for what the problems that we have right now, which is smaller levels of troops, but still actively engaged in the fight, not nation building. So,
but we're still spending $5 billion a year on Afghan security forces. Yeah, and the documents that were just leaked said that they couldn't find enough places to spend the money. They were wasting it on stuff they knew they were never going to use. I mean, so as a conservative, yeah. I'm like, we're sending our tax dollars when we're even admitting we're not spending the money properly to a country halfway around the world that was involved in 9/11 alongside a collection of other countries.
That's exactly why we send it there. I mean, you just made the case right there.
So we should send it to Pakistan and we should spend...
We do involve ourselves in Pakistan, yes.
So you agree that we should continue to send money to countries that hate us.
National defense, we're not giving them money just because they hate us.
No, but I'm not saying that. I said we are sending money to countries that hate us.
I think you're looking for a perfect solution to foreign policy.
Better.
Better then?
End the war in Afghanistan.
Well, how do you end the war? And then what do you do?
So you pull out the troops.
Okay.
Negotiate with the Taliban like Ronald Reagan did and H.W. Bush did and W. Bush did.
Okay. So we're going to pull out the troops. We're going to lose all leverage that we could ever have. And then the Taliban what's that negotiation look like?
What does it look like?
What are the Taliban going to give us?
You work with the Afghan government.
You
work with the Afghan government and the Taliban and you work with concessions.
What does that mean, work with? What happens?
Sit down and negotiate.
Negotiate what? What's our goal there?
Terms of withdrawal.
There's no leverage. The Taliban have no incentive to negotiate anything with us if we're not there, if we just pull out.
What the worst case scenario, what the Taliban is going to do when we
9/11, the same thing. I mean, we only have to look at recent history.
Keep going back to that. They were not the sole actor behind that.
But they actively
were an ingredient. There are a lot of places that condone it. I mean, Hezbollah and Hamas condone it.
Sure, but
we don't have troops in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, but again, you remember 2001 and what was happening at that time. They refused to stop giving harbor to Osama bin Laden and his lackeys and al-Qaeda. And that's why we invaded, right? And again, something I believe we agree on. You just don't like the number of people.
And the duration and the lack of clarity of victory or the vision of what success looks like.
That's frustrating. I get it. But national security abroad in places like this is always going to lack clarity. I mean, the other interesting thing I believe is interesting about this is, you know, especially with the Syria conversation, we had like 1,000 troops there. Weren't really actively engaged in warfare. It was mostly
support. So you're talking about the Kurdish
issue, but even Afghanistan. Everybody's freaking out about these particular places, but nobody says anything about the 30,000 troops in South Korea, 50,000 troops in Japan,
but
they're not active war zones. You don't like war. It's like that's what gets to you.
Yeah, by the way, I love what Trump is doing to make these countries pay.
Which countries?
NATO, Germany, pay their 2%.
Sure.
Make Japan pay for defense.
So you don't like the fact that our troops are engaged in any kind of fighting
or nation building or trying
to. Well, they're not engaged in nation building right
now. In Afghanistan, sure they are.
No, they're not.
Then where's the money going then?
We don't have nearly enough people there to be engaged in nation building.
So tell me where the $5 billion a year is going.
Well, $5 billion goes like that.
It's a lot of money.
Our defense budget is $750 billion.
Right, which is way too much, but $5 billion is a lot of money.
Why is that too much?
Why is it too much?
Well, I mean, what's the right amount?
Less.
Why?
Because we're everywhere.
Who is going to take up that vacuum if we
leave? How about Saudi Arabia pays $30 billion afford? South Korea pays $10 billion for the base there.
Well, South Korea does split
Japan
the cost
pays
with us.
$15 billion. Germany should pay $7 billion. Norway, which sits on $1 trillion.
And they pay these things.
No, they don't. Norway does not pay what they should. They said the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world. They're sitting on $1 trillion.
Okay.
They don't pay what they should.
I'm talking about you said Japan, Germany, and Japan. Listen, I don't know what they are paying, but they're not paying. You just made up a bunch of numbers and said, okay, they should pay this.
Well, they're rough estimates based on the amount of troops we have and the cost that it goes to run the base.
Sure, I guess. You're not being very clear with these numbers, and you're making up an idealistic sense of how it should be, but without really defining what that is.
It's very properly realistic in a sense. Americans have the right instincts of being war-weary in Afghanistan.
I use those examples because nobody ever talks about those. They just talk about Afghanistan and Syria.
I talk about it very favorably.
So you want all of our troops back?
I didn't say a total and complete withdrawal, but I'll give you another example. I don't understand why we have to continually buy weaponry at the price points we're buying them from the same defense contractors time and time again when they've proven to have very questionable bidding processes and technology that doesn't always work, Boeing being a great example.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
You
can talk about the acquisition process all day long. I mean, but then point me to the people who are making those, and we'll be happy to try and buy from them. But the let's keep the you got to keep the discussion focused on, because I'm trying to get at what really frustrates you, because you don't like fighting, right? You don't like fighting abroad.
I don't like death. Trump says, sand and death.
Most people don't. And that's why you send people like me who understand what needs to be done there. And that's fine. I would just appreciate allowing us to get it done.
And aimless conflict.
Right. But that's the word you used, aimless, is just incorrect. And I've explained over and over again why that's incorrect. And there's complexity and nuance to these issues that I think you're oversimplifying massively. And there's this, what I also get the sense of is, generally speaking, and I'm not saying you believe this by any means, but it is the natural conclusion of the belief, which is national defense looks something like, instead of SEALs going abroad, it's like us guarding our shores and just guarding our beaches. And we'll look abroad, we'll look up with our telescopes, and we'll look up with our satellites, and we'll see what's going on out there, but we're not going to go get it. That's not national defense, not in this world, not in a world where it's a 12-hour flight from here to the Middle East, not in a world where information travels even faster than that and can radicalize people here. Like, you have to have these troop presence abroad. And there is a vacuum that takes place when you don't have it, whether that vacuum is terrorists like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, who then want to gain some space and then plan accordingly, or other actors like China and Russia who will fill the vacuum as well. And so, you know, it does get into a much bigger strategy with a much more complex questions that need to be asked, which is, what is America's role in the world? And again, libertarian types, I get it, tend to be much more isolationist and defend the shores from the shorelines. I'm not in that category because it doesn't work. And it's easy to nitpick our history and say, well, that hasn't worked either. Well, kind of, but you have nothing to compare it to either. You know, so it's a bit of an unfair critique in a lot of ways, and it assumes some kind of utopian thinking that which of how it should be and how it could be, and I think to get to that sort of utopian ideal, you have to be overly simplistic in the analysis of what's going on.
If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. I can tell you, we just got out of long meetings here at Turning Point USA talking about all the different numbers and everything we're doing at Turning Point USA. And I'm telling you, if you do not know your bottom line, then you are not going to be successful as a business owner or as an entrepreneur. That is what NetSuite by Oracle has set out to solve. Most companies do not have a clear picture of their finances, and that's why many businesses fail. The question for any business owner out there is, are you confident that you've got the right numbers at your fingertips? My personal demo of NetSuite was super impressive. Having bad information or no information or flying blind, you can't do that. And NetSuite has a really great way of organizing data and making sure you know the numbers for your business. Serious entrepreneurs and finance teams run by NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. It's a terrific system. NetSuite offers a full picture of all your finances all in one place in real time right from your phone or desktop. No more guessing. No more worry that you don't know what could kill your company. Now you're going to get an exact report and you're going to know exactly what is driving your business. That's why NetSuite customers grew 3 times faster than the S&P 500. It's amazing. So if you use NetSuite, 3 times faster growth. So you want a free demo? You get a free demo by NetSuite by Oracle. It's terrific. I'm telling you, I've done it. It's really impressive. And you receive your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/Kirk. That's netsuite.com/Kirk. If you have a business and you want to make sure that you are not losing money and going to be successful, you guys have got to use NetSuite by Oracle. It's netsuite.com/Kirk. Get your free demo, get your free guide today, netsuite.com/Kirk. There's a big debate on the right now, Congressman, about what to do with some of these like societal problems we have culturally and what the size and scope of government should be on issues like tech and issues, you know, even like banning pornography, all that sort of stuff. Where do you fall kind of down on a lot of those issues? And I know that's open-ended. You might have been seeing some of
two different ones, yeah.
But you've probably seen some of these debates pop up online about where government should get involved in more cultural and economic issues.
So you mentioned tech and pornography. Let's stick with tech.
Yeah, let's do tech. That's fine.
It's somewhat related. No, actually, no, it's really not. On the tech side, it's still a difficult one because, you know, what what is government's role in telling Facebook what they can censor and what they can't? I think our best bet still is public outcry over it and naming and shaming of the kind of censorship that they do engage in. And more importantly, the vague standards. There's a lot of people who would have you believe, and there's some good evidence for this, that the left wing activists complain just as much as the right wing activists do to about censorship to Facebook and Google and all these places. Maybe that's true. Maybe it isn't. It's hard to root out those numbers. The problem fundamentally is that their standards are vague. They're half public or half publisher, half platform. There's some legislation in the Senate that seeks to clarify that. I don't know it well enough to speak to it right now, but it's with Senator Hawley's proposed that, and it deals with Section 230 and that divide of the protection of publisher versus platform. Publisher meaning you're like a newspaper. You can be sued if you publish something wrong. Platform meaning you're just a place for people to come to. So it's an interesting debate. Legally, what we do about it without ourselves infringing on the First Amendment, that's still an open question. And the answer so far is there's not a whole lot we can do except continue to use our voice to try and thwart it. The pornography debate's an interesting one that just popped up out of nowhere on the conservative side.
I only mentioned it because it's been kind of in.
Yeah. It's not something I've weighed into. We had impeachment this week, right? We're passing appropriations bills this week. There's more important things to discuss. I'll let the conservative talking heads online continue to hash that one out. Because it's not high on my priority list. Yeah,
it seems that there is this coming debate and divide, though, between should we use the instruments of government while we possibly can to pass more rules and regulation to try to protect traditional conservative morality.
Yeah, and that is a good question.
Which is where it kind of stems from.
Right. And it's a good question. It's an interesting question. It's sort of the difference between conservatives and libertarians. I think a libertarian would say no, absolutely not, never, which is frankly why I'm not a libertarian, because I think it's a good market theory. I think it falls apart as a governing theory and as a foreign policy. So that's why I'm a conservative. Now, that being said, you have to have limiting principles as a conservative, like what the government really can and can't do. Just because I'm a conservative and I believe in advocating for a sense of morality doesn't quite mean that I want to use the power of government to enforce that morality. So it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. Unless that morality is the obvious, right? Like, do not murder people. there's some very obvious things that the government should enforce. But we define those things clearly. And they're usually defined as, is somebody infringing on the rights of another? Life, liberty, and property. That's usually a pretty good standard to have when you're thinking about what the government should use the tool of law to enforce. Is somebody infringing on somebody else's rights, life, liberty, and property?
And most libertarians would agree with that.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Where conservatives might go a little bit further is that both policy and culture can be instructive towards human behavior, right? Is that, for example, they would point to drunk driving laws and domestic violence going down because of harsher penalties towards that they both can be constructive. So we only have like 2 minutes remaining. Do you think President Trump will get reelected in 2020?
It's looking good right now. I think it does depend on on who comes out of the Democrat primary. I think this impeachment nonsense is good for the president. Mm-hmm. We'll see what new narrative the Democrats want to spin over the next year.
Well, because I think part of it is that if they get a Supreme Court nominee, they want to say an impeached president should not be able to nominate a Supreme Court nominee.
Oh, that's an interesting theory. Yeah. Well, he's technically
that's
not
from
impeached
Mark
yet.
Levin. I wish I could take credit for it, but it's Mark Levin.
Yeah. Although there's some good evidence.
I steal stuff from all these people. So.
Yeah. Hey, there's no patent on good ideas. So. Or good sayings. So it's looking good right now. I mean, Biden, I think, is just from the polling, and I think intuitively the president's the biggest competitor. But he does seem
How's your
sleepy.
Race look? How's your race looking?
Well, I got Beto trying to hit up my race
for Congress.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, no, he's supporting one of his staffers who came in. So I thought
Robert Francis O'Rourke.
Yeah, he grew a beard. He's still wearing his blue shirt that he's been wearing for like 4 years. But
he's born to be in it or something.
Born to be in it.
Yeah, what was that craziest phrase he had?
Yeah, we should.
Robert Francis O'Rourke.
He's ridiculous.
The fake Hispanic Irishman from El Paso.
You know, but we do need some help. CrunchOfForCongress.com.
You got it. Help him out. Well, Congressman, this was fun. I appreciate it.
Hey,
so,
it's great
always
to be spirited.
You bet. Thanks, man. What a great conversation that was with Congressman Dan Crenshaw. I apologize for somewhat of the abrupt ending there. That was right before he took the stage at our Turning Point USA, TPUSA.com event in Palm Beach, and he just kind of got the hook and he had to get up on stage. So we had to end that rather abruptly, but those are the kind of conversations that the conservative movement needs to have about limiting these endless wars overseas, the amount of money, the amount of waste that happens when we occupy nations while our own nation ourselves is crumbling. Lots to think about there. I hope we are able to start some conversation between you and some people on the right or on the left. Please tell other people about our podcast and point them to that conversation with Dan Crenshaw, because I think that is highly instructive. And make sure you are subscribed. Type in The Charlie Kirk Show, press subscribe, give us those 5-star reviews. And of course, if you want to get involved with the nation's most powerful student organization fighting on high school or college campuses across the country, you can go to one of our events, start a chapter, become a leader. If you're already a leader, get involved at tpusa.com, or you can chip in some money. That's tpusa.com. All right, thank you, everybody. Till next time, this is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show. And before I sign off, make sure you email us at freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com, because we have an Ask Me Anything episode coming up soon. freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thanks, everybody.
There are things that should not be. Copycat killers. They exist. Those who are compelled to turn bloody fiction into a real-life horror story.
He was inspired by the Joker.
They do it because the acts give them power and control.
The license to kill.
Life imitates art, and unfortunately, so does death.
From Reels and Podcast One, who brought you Murder Made Me Famous, comes the next great true crime podcast, Copycat Killers. Join host Dr. J. Buzz Von Ornsteiner as he analyzes true crimes based on Hollywood hits. New episodes every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.